So let me start our lecture on Astrophysics 2, which is devoted to stellar interiors. And usually I start with some news, astrophysical news. And just a few minutes ago, I noticed one nice paper in Astronomy and Astrophysics. So just let me share the screen. So let me see at least the abstract and a few figures. Actually, it's a paper which is really closely related to our lecture, to these lectures, because it's called Calibrating Core Overshooting Parameters with Two-Dimensional Hydrodynamical Simulations. Well, just let me explain that it's one of the very important processes which occurs in stars, which is the convection, transport of matter by means of turbulence, which can transport the heat from one place to another place. And that's a very big question. What is or how the turbulence looks like in stellar interiors? It's an unsolved problem. And these hydrodynamical simulations are really useful to understand what is going on in stellar interiors. So just let me skip and find figures I noticed. Of course, when you compute something numerically, you have to explain what is included in your model. This is a very important part of the paper. So I usually expect that they start with a set of equations, because it's very useful and would like to compare, for example, our model. I'm going to discuss one-dimensional model of stellar interior in our introductory lecture. And here you can see a two-dimensional model. It's the very center of a star, actually a close vicinity of a core. It's only 0.2 or 0.3 solar radii, as you can see here. And what you can see is a very complex pattern, and something like a few whirls. Looks like a few small galaxies, right? But these whirls are actually the bubbles created by turbulence. And now we are interested, for example, what is the rate of energy transfer from the stellar, from this case, stellar core, to the envelope? And it really depends on how the turbulence occurs. What are the velocities in stellar interior? So that's something which we are going to discuss, I think, in lecture 6 or 7, how this can be computed or at least estimated. So this is one of the papers which occurred among highlights in Astronomy and Astrophysics. And, you know, I was quite happy 1 month ago when our paper also occurred among highlighted papers. I think it's somewhere here. So let me show it too, because it's also related to this lecture. It's a paper about a binary system, which is quite complicated, because the two stars are so close together that mass is transferred between the components. And as a result, just let me open it so we can see the abstract and the title. It's a star called Beta Lyrae A, which is, let me say, surrounded by circumstellar medium. And this medium is essentially an accretion disk. And that's something which is very common in the universe, because, you know, every rotating structure, I mean, a fast rotating structure, is a flattened disk. So disks are very common structures in the universe. And that's why we studied this interesting system. It was not easy for us, because we had to combine a lot of observational data. It's one of the best observed systems and stellar systems in the universe. So we had light curves, for example. This is the first part of our model. We had interferometric visibilities. That's something which I'm not going to explain in this lecture, but in, I think, Astrophysics 1 or the basics of astrophysics is devoted to the explanation of interferometric observations. We also use closure phases and triple products, which are more complex observables. When you combine, for example, three telescopes of the interferometer, you can construct a quantity which is called closure phase, and it's one of the most interesting quantities you can measure, because it's not affected by seeing. Just imagine, right? What kind of quantity it is? It's a very important to measure these so-called self-calibrated quantities. And finally, let me mention that we also modeled spectral energy distribution and calibrated or rectified spectra. And also one very nice quantity, which is called a differential amplitude and differential phase. Something I'm not going to explain today, maybe on a seminar during this semester, but let me show you the result, right? We used, as a backend, we used radiative transfer code called Shellspec, which can be used to model the radiative transfer through the circumstellar medium. So you start with a stellar atmosphere, and then you propagate through the interstellar medium. But just let me mute one user, because it was a bit distracting. Okay. And so the outcome is a geometrical model of the system, which fulfills all these various types of observations. So just let me skip to the model, but of course we have to compare very carefully the observations with our model. And the outcome is, I think, on page 8 or 9. So here is it. It's a system, I mean, the binary star with a accretion disk, as you can see here. And it's quite it was quite fascinating to see how the system differs in different wavelengths. What you can see here, the top figure is in ultraviolet, and the bottom one is in far infrared. And of course, the structure, even the sizes, the atmospheres are totally different for different wavelengths. And this is, I think, even more interesting. It's a scan across the H alpha line, which is a single and very important spectral line in the spectrum. And when you scan over the spectral line, you can essentially measure the velocities, but not only their magnitudes, because you observe by an interferometer, you measure the spatial distribution of velocities when you scan over the line profile. And that's what can be seen here. This is out of line image, the upper left. And as you approach the center of the H alpha line, you see different structures. For example, these jets are only visible at large velocities, because the jet is fast expanding gas. On the other hand, we also detected this more or less spherical envelope, which is probably slowly moving matter, which was ejected in the past, and then due to turbulent motions was left in the surroundings of this binary. It's optically thin, so that you can see only, you can only see it in the middle of the H alpha line, not in the neighboring continuum. And finally, you can see very nice structures on the surface or in the atmosphere of the disk, because when you scan across a disk, you simply measure the orbital velocity of the disk. And the orbital velocity is large in the center and smaller at the edge of the disk. So that's something I wanted to show with you, to share with you. And which is, well, it's a complicated system, but I hope that we, at the end of this lecture or this semester, we will understand what is going on in these, even in these complex systems. So let me start with an overview of literature. I brought at least a few books with me so that you can choose anyone you would like. Okay, that's the point. Of course, the simplest option is this one. It's written by Professor Petr Harmanec and me a few years ago. Actually, it's already 10 years ago. And it's essentially one-to-one. It's corresponding one-to-one to a lecture as it was held 10 years ago. Of course, I would like to update at least a few lectures this year, but I think the first part of this book will be very useful for you. It's written in Czech, but I will explain it in English during our lectures, and I will also try to translate at least the most important or the key sections of this book. This one is a classical book from, I think, 80s by Professor Vanísek. It's called Základy astronomie and astrofyziky. That was a book which was available at the time when I was a student. It's maybe it's not only the astrophysics, and the astrophysics is only a smaller part of this book. And maybe the equations I'm mostly interested in are not explained that clearly as I try during this lecture. So it's a, let me say, a small warning, but it's one of the previous textbooks. Another option is this book by Michael Stix, The Sun, a very useful book for a solar astrophysicist, but I think chapter 2 is a brief summary of stellar evolution and stellar structure equations. So for someone who needs at least a brief introduction, it's very useful. And by the way, it's also a very useful book for observers. I admired their insight into solar observations and techniques which are used to cope with solar observation. You know, by the way, the sun is the closest star, and we all know what does it mean. Another one is this Schatzmann und Praderie, The Stars. I think it was the book which Peter used to prepare the very first version of this lecture. So it might be quite nice to see the original reference. But again, I hope that our lecture will be, let me say, structured differently. And the organization of this lecture is generally that we first discuss the basic equations, then their numerical solution, because that's it's quite common these days that the equations can be solved numerically, while the analytical solution is much more difficult or it's limited by various approximations. So that's why we prefer numerical solution even in this lecture on stellar interiors. And a few more books. Let me use this one. I think it's a very nice summary, and it's really devoted to stellar interiors. Hansen, Cavalier, and Virginia Tremble on stellar interiors. And myself, I studied, I think, stellar oscillations in this book, and it's really nicely written, and I can recommend it to you. Another option, let me choose this one. And it's actually the second part of this lecture will be devoted to more complicated situations, like binaries. And it's written by Peter Eggleton. Peter is one of the best known scientists studying binary stars and their evolution. So it's, I think, nice to read a book written by someone who is such a good scientist. Right? It's, I think, one of the people which has huge number of articles about binary stars.
Excuse me.
Sure.
Can you just repeat the title of the book?
Okay, the title is Evolutionary Processes in Binary and Multiple Stars. I hope that it will be visible.
No, that's fine. I just, but.
And it's Eggleton. Of course.
Is it in your, the literature?
I think it's included in the literature, right? In the list of literature.
Okay.
And another option is this book by André Meder. I think he's originally from Geneva or Geneva Group. It's a famous and well-known group of astrophysicists from Switzerland who study stars, and especially they focus on rotating stars. And it's it's a very important stuff, right? Because all stars rotate, including our sun. Although in case of our sun, the rotation is so slow that stars are very close to spheres. If you look at the sky, I'm sure that you will say that it's spherical, but stars can rotate fast and they can deform. And most importantly, they'll circulate differently inside their interiors. And of course, this affects everything. This can affect turbulence, this can affect heat transfer, etc. So it's quite important to understand rotating stars. This is a beautiful monograph. And finally, I have these big books, let me say. This is by Ico Iben, Stellar Evolution Physics. It's a really big book, maybe a bit too detailed, because when I studied, I think there is an example of stellar evolution for, I think, either the sun or maybe five solar mass star. It's a very detailed discussion of all the profiles which are which were computed in stellar interiors. And you know, when the description is 40 pages, it really takes time to overcome all the details. So in our case, I'm not going to discuss the evolution in such a great amount of detail. I actually tried to say, to discuss more general processes which occur in many different situations, in many different stars, and even for different stellar masses. And finally, this is a series of books. And this volume 4 is devoted to stellar structure and evolution. It's by Oswald, editor-in-chief. And again, we used this book with students. And it seemed to me that, you look at the author list, it's quite clear that, for example, chapter 2 is written by Ivan Hubeny, one of, well, maybe not one of, but the best our astrophysicist, which is an expert on stellar atmospheres. So, you know, when you when you are interested in important things, just study texts written by people studying important things, like a company. For us, stellar atmospheres will be mostly treated as boundary conditions. So in because we are mostly focused on stellar interiors. But today I already understand that stellar atmospheres are key to understand not only the atmosphere itself, but how it propagates into the stellar interior. And finally, I have a very nice book by Chandrasekhar. An Introduction to the Study of Stellar Structure. You know, Chandrasekhar is known for many different things, but of course, as a good astrophysicist, he knew very well that this is a classical part of astrophysics. And again, it was a pleasure for me to read at least a few chapters from this book. I'm not sure if it's enough time to read everything, right? I'm almost certain that it's not the case. But of course, you should know at least about these books, and maybe sometimes in the future, we will use them to understand some details. All right, so what to do next? I'd like to present an outline of this course. So the outline. So today I'm going to discuss the energy budget. Or let me write it as an energy order of magnitude estimates. And I think it's quite important to try yourself to estimate some or to address some processes by means of order of magnitude estimates. Because if you don't understand these, how can you understand the details, right? The energetics of stars is quite important to understand. We will treat it as sources of energy, but of course the word source is a bit dangerous because energy is conserved. The total energy of your system, if it's isolated system, is conserved. So it's actually a transformation of one energy type to another energy type. I think the second, or maybe in our lecture notes, it's the third chapter, will be devoted to the state equation. The state equation is simple in the sense that it's not a complicated differential equation. It's a relation between the state quantities, and usually we use P as a function of rho and T. And it's a given function for us, although it can be pretty complicated, right? Sometimes you have to compute some integrals, sometimes you have to use some pre-computed tables because it's related to a microscopic or quantum mechanical behavior of matter. An alternative form of the state equation might be P as a function of the internal energy and or density and the internal energy. Okay. So I'm going to discuss at least four contributions which have to be included to the state equation. Otherwise, you would never understand stars and their, let me say, late evolution. Number four are stellar structure equations. But this is the key, right? That something you should know at midnight, any time of the year, right? And I will try to explain it in detail so that we understand why there are powers in the numerator, why there are different powers of different quantities in the denominator. And we will derive these stellar structure equations from more general equations. And we will simplify them to be useful for us, because we are mostly interested in a 1D spherically symmetric case. So in using this geometrical simplification, we are going to derive all these equations. And number five is, what is it? I think there should be a lecture devoted to initial and boundary conditions. Again, well, all physical laws I know of are differential equations, essentially. But of course, the number of solutions is infinite. And when you are interested in a particular case, you have to specify both initial and boundary conditions. And I've already warned you that boundary conditions, especially the outer boundary conditions, can be, let me say, beasts, because they are complex atmospheres, right? For example, the beta Lyrae A system I explained a few minutes ago. In this case, the atmosphere is of the hot component is probably non-LTE atmosphere, I mean, not a simple equilibrium atmosphere. And this creates some signature in spectra. The depth of spectral lines, which we observe, is different from simple atmospheric models. So we would like to compare any observation. It's quite important to understand these outer boundary conditions quite clearly, especially if you are interested in a one particular system. Number six is a mathematical structure. Mathematical description of the equations. Number seven is a discussion of their numerical solution. Numerical solution by means of the Henier method. Well, please do not blame me that I'm going to discuss one particular numerical method when there is millions, well, at least thousands of numerical methods available, right? But you know, this is a very nice example how you can transform a system of differential equations to a set of algebraic equations. So that's why we do it, right? Because it's very common. It's a must to understand how you can transform a set of differential equations into a set of algebraic equations. And I'm practically sure that any practical stellar evolution code includes a variation of any method. For example, we shall use a so-called Mesastar code. And if you look closely what's going on here inside this code, you will find that at, I think it's a 16th or 17th level in the program, you will immediately realize that it's a method which is practically the same as the Henny method. All right, number eight is...
I'm sorry, but could you move the camera closer to the board? Because
okay, I can.
For me to resolve the words.
You mean this camera?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
It's
but you know, it's only a brief summary, right? It's not an equation or so.
Yeah.
So just,
okay.
Of course, I'm glad if you would like to write down something. I think it's a very important part of learning to summarize it yourself, to write down everything, but it's not yet the key part of the lecture. Number eight is an example. I mean, an example of a stellar evolution. And that's another part which I hope will be useful for you, not because I'm going to discuss one particular star, but because you will understand why I discuss the evolutionary processes, why they are important, what can happen during the evolution, right? We essentially shall use the classical Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, but not only this diagram, because, you know, it's only the surface, but we shall use more involved view graphs and computations to understand also the interior. But as a rule, right, if you have an HR diagram and there is an evolutionary track, you go somewhere, right, and then the evolution So what are the heating mechanisms or energy budget? Well, it might seem that this discussion is trivial, but it's quite important to try these order of magnitudes estimates. So let me discuss a hypothetical case that there is no heating in other words there is only cooling from some previous hot state. What does it mean? It means that we have some heat content in our sun. I will use it as a profound example, which is roughly speaking, proportional to the mass of the sun, the thermal capacity, and a change of temperature. It's the current heat content which you can obtain if the sun is cooled down from the current temperature down to zero, right, for example. So let's try it. The mass is 2 × 10⁻³० kilograms. Then regarding the thermal capacity, I'm going to use 450 joules per Kelvin per kilogram. I think it's the value for iron, but it doesn't matter, right? You know, all the astronomers thought about the sun as an hot iron because they saw hot iron in the oven, and so that's why I'm going to use this. And the maximum delta T is 6,000 Kelvin, and as an outcome, we shall have 5.4 times 10 to the power of 36 joules. Well, I don't know whether it's large or small, because we have to always compare to something, right? We cannot decide easily whether it's large or small, but we can do it. We can do it as follows. Let me compute a time scale as Q divided by the power of our sun, I mean the current power, which is denoted as L sun, and it's this number in joules divided by the solar luminosity, which is approximately 3.8 times 10 to the power of 26 joules, no, sorry, watts. And as an outcome, I have 1.4 times 10 to the power of 10 seconds, which is easy to divide by 10 to the power of 7, so that you get approximately 460 years. So it's not much. It's a very low number, actually, and it's surprisingly low number. I think, well, of course, old Greek astronomers did not understand the concept of temperature, the concept of thermal capacity, but at least from the time of Joule, who invented the energy conservation law, they understood that this cannot be the case, because 460 years is essentially too small number. However, that's a very common addition, right? However, it's not related for our sun. We have two or at least two types of stars for which this process is the key. It's the evolutionary process. And these are the white dwarfs. And let me denote them by this abbreviation, which is white dwarf. Or brown dwarfs. Because these objects at late stages of evolution are driven by simple cooling and nothing else. The second process I'd like to understand are the chemical reactions. Chemical reactions, again, can be estimated in a similar way. It's the mass, but not of the whole sun. Let me use only mass of hydrogen content in our sun, multiplied by the calorific value, denoted as H. Česky bychom řekli výhřevnost or calorific value. And it's roughly So it's less than 2 times 10 to the power of 30. And I don't remember exactly the fraction. I see, the fraction. It depends on what we imagine. What kind of chemical reaction is it? So if it's a simple fusion, H2 or 2H2 plus O2, which comes out as 2 water molecules, then the fraction of hydrogen has to be very small, roughly 1/9, multiplied by the mass of our sun and the calorific value, which is 10 to the power of 8 joules. And the result is 2.5 times 10 to 37 joules. Well, it's slightly better, but not that much, because the time scale is about 2,000 years. And it was well known at the time of Joule or Herschel that, again, chemical reactions are not enough to power our sun over long time scales. Nevertheless, of course, chemical reactions are very important for interstellar medium. And if you would like to understand the origin of stars, for example, these protostars, not speaking about these first stars in the universe, is the key to understand these reactions and their output, right? So let me point out interstellar medium is indeed strongly affected by chemical reactions. Actually, a recombination of hydrogen is also a chemical reaction, right? Ionization of hydrogen is also a photochemical reaction. So that's why we consider them also very important. The third process is the accretion. Well, how can we do it? We can do it as follows. I can imagine that a matter is accreted onto the surface of our sun continuously, and its kinetic energy is 1.5 mv². And then my question is, when the power of our sun is constant, what is the mass accretion? This viscosity is used as a mechanical way how to transport matter from one place to another. It's something like an internal friction, and that's why the accretion disks proceed. Alternatively, it's a, let me say, quite a relatively new stuff. Disks and matter can also accrete when you drive a wind. Right? That's another option, that you drive a strong wind in the atmosphere of the disk, and as a result, the disk can accrete.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
When you mean viscosity, do you mean the density of the dust clouds, which are there by for forming the accretion disk? Like you have the dust clouds, right? And
well, actually, the viscosity occurs mostly in the gaseous component of disks, right? The dust is not so relevant, mostly because, you know, every dust occurs, it appears as distinct grains. And there is a gap between these grains, right? So that their pressure and their connection, interconnection, their interaction is not so strong as in the gaseous component. Right? The gas can have its own friction, which is called viscosity or for fluids.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Thanks. So it's mostly the gaseous component. And let me also add one more information about the viscosity. Sometimes the viscosity is not only the friction, but it's an effect of small scale vortices, small scale whirls, right? If you have a vortex, for example, just imagine that in front of me, let me zoom it in a little bit, right? So just imagine that in front of you, there is a vortex, a small mm-hmm. vortex. What happens? Well, in this layer, the vortex brings some momentum, right? And in this layer, the vortex carries away some momentum. And any momentum exchange by means of vortices means that there is a connection between different layers. And as a result, you will have non-zero viscosity. So that's a side note, but related to the accretion. I see. Number four is a contraction. Or in other words, we are going to discuss the gravitational potential energy, because it can be released by means of contraction. So what is the amount of energy we can release this way? I think, you notice this delta E, which is the gravitational energy at infinite radius for a very extended object, and minus energy at the current radius. And this is, surprisingly, 3/10 gm² divided by r. And my question is, well, first, you should understand why there is g multiplied by m squared. Well, it's logical. It's the self-gravity, right, of the object. So that's why. Divided by r, and it's the same as for two-point masses, logical. But why there is a factor of 3/10? Well, for a homogeneous sphere, you would expect, let me compare it to a homogeneous sphere, you would expect 3/5 in terms of gravitational potential energy, but the energy which can be released as heat is only 1/2 of this gravitational potential energy. And that's because we have the so-called virial theorem, which tells us it's a relation between gravitational potential energy and the kinetic energy. And my question here is, what is this relation, right? There is a blank space in front of both letters. And let me ask you, what is the relation between EG and EK if you are in equilibrium?
It should be twice.
And where is the factor two? Which of the two energies is larger?
Twice the kinetic energy equals gravitational energy.
Well, if it would be equal exactly, right, then the total energy is zero, and essentially it's a free state. But it's not the case, right? What I think of is a bounded system which is in equilibrium. So how you can imagine it? For example, a planet orbiting a star like this is exactly this kind of bound system in equilibrium, right? And
I'm sorry. So in the state of equilibrium, it should be twice the kinetic energy plus the gravitational energy equals zero.
Okay, so in our case, it's number two is here, right? Or in other words, one half is on the left-hand side. And what about the sign?
Yeah, you are missing.
It'd be negative.
And which one is negative? Well, there is a minus sign.
Gravitational energy is negative in bounded systems. So, yeah.
I think the total energy is negative.
Yeah,
right.
That's what I meant. Right.
The total energy is negative. So that, just let me, I think it's like this, isn't it? Because it's the kinetic energy is minus one half EG. And if I sum up EG plus EK, no, it's the opposite, isn't it? Because I would obtain minus 2 EK plus EK, which is equal to minus 1 EK, which is surely negative because the kinetic energy is always positive, right? So this is the total energy. And just let me recall, it's exactly the situation when you have a planet orbiting a star like this. And you can even compute it yourself because you know very well the orbital velocity in this case. It's equal to the Keplerian velocity, which is gm sun in this case, divided by r and the square root of it. And you will immediately realize that this is exactly this situation. All right, so for stars, this contraction is usually very slow for stable stars or stable evolutionary phases. However, we have phases where this contraction is much more important, so that, again, these are the protostars. You can also see that some evolutionary phases, for example, during the SGB phase, can heat the interior simply because the core is contracting and is releasing the heat inside its stellar interior. And in a similar way, it's the case of the deep interior of the red giant stars located on the red giant branch. Or as we say, red giants. All right. So, by the way, in other words, this is called the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability or Kelvin-Helmholtz timescale. And it's equal to this delta E divided by L sun, which is substantially longer, 10 to 7 years. And I think that at that time, both Kelvin and Helmholtz were satisfied with this number because it seems like a sufficiently long time scale to describe the evolutionary processes they saw in nature. Unfortunately, today we understand it's not enough. It's enough for erosion because, you know, as a geologist, you would understand that the erosion of rocks takes some time. The sedimentation of rocks also takes some time, but it's probably enough to explain these erosion and sedimentary processes. However, the radiometric method, I'll tell you later on that some of the rocks are much older than this. And even some fossils are older than this. And that's the reason why we need additional heating mechanisms. And that's why I'm going to discuss the, I think, remaining three mechanisms. One is related to ionization. You know, the ionization is a quite a substantial energy for a single atom, namely hydrogen from the base level.
Could you please move the camera? We can't see.
Sure. Thank you for advice. Like this. So the ionization energy is equal to 13.6 electron volts. And just let me recall that electron volt is equal to 1.6 times 10 to minus 19 joules. Just we have these unit conversions taken into account. And what does the total energy which can be released during recombination, or which can be consumed during ionization? It's the total mass divided by mass of a single atom multiplied by this ion energy. And I obtained a number 2.7 times 10 to 39 joules, which is great because the time scale is roughly 200,000 years. And that's something which I consider really substantial, especially for protostars and pre-main sequence stars. Because these are even the evolutionary timescales of these pre-main sequence stars, right? Hundreds of thousand years or a few millions of years are the evolutionary timescales. And of course, it helps a lot when you can consume the energy by increasing the internal ionization energy, because it can cool down your protostar. And that's something which warns us that cooling that's something which indicates that cooling is indeed very important, maybe more important than heating. And finally, discuss nuclear fission. The fission process using some sort of a classical source like the uranium. What does it mean? It means that you can release roughly 200 mega electron volts by means of fission of a uranium nucleus. And the outcome is, of course, M sun divided by M on the uranium atom times E of one fission. And you end up with 1.6 multiplied by 10 to the power of 44. The only problem is to concentrate uranium, right? Because it's only a single element. And it's hard to imagine that the sun or any object in the universe is mostly made of radioactive nuclei. Nevertheless, it's an important source for planets and asteroids. So even at low concentrations of radioactive elements, the interior of planets and asteroids are heated, at least initially, by these radioactive elements, especially aluminium 26. And sometimes the time scale of this decay, so actually we cannot choose the time scale here because the decay rate is given for given element. So it's not a free parameter in our case, but sometimes the time scale can be sufficiently long to contribute to heating of planets or asteroids. And finally, let me discuss a fusion. A fusion can release roughly, denote it as E nuclear, can release roughly 26 mega electron volts of energy. And the outcome is 2.3 times 10 to the power of 44 joules, or the time scale, which is of the order of 2 times 10 to the power of 10 years, which is great, right? Finally, we have a source which is, first, which has a sufficiently large heat content to cover at least the current luminosity, and at the same time, the source must not be too effective, right? It's a, and we will see it in a few hours, that it's quite important that these fusion reactions do not occur too fast, right? Fast reactions are dangerous because they can lead to explosion. In this case, it's a very slow fusion, especially because one of the reactions is very slow. Of course, there's nothing comparable to fusion which occurs or which should occur in tokamaks, in reactors on our Earth. It's a totally different process occurring on a very different time scale. And again, it's something very different from a fission, which occurs in our atomic power plants, because again, on the sun, these processes would be useless. They would be way too fast, and they will release a lot of energy too quickly. All right, so that's my goal for the first part of our lecture. And we can follow, if there are no questions, we can follow with chapter 3.
I have no question, but I would like to ask you sure. whether you could move the camera closer to the board, because for me it's really hard to resolve the
I see, okay. Because I see it quite clearly, but it's not always the case, right? So let me do it. Something like this is sufficient. Is it better?
Yeah, that might be too much, maybe. Because now I can see the right part of the board. Yeah.
Let me try like this, okay?
Yes, this is much better.
Okay, surprisingly, it's only a few centimeters. All right, so let me move on and let me discuss the state equation. Which is chapter 3 in our lecture notes. And let me do it quite quickly. Because the first part of the state equation is indeed very simple. It's the ideal gas state equation. And you already know it very well from either thermodynamics or statistical physics, of course. It means that pressure or a contribution to pressure is equal to rho divided by mu mu multiplied by kT, where the quantities are the atomic unit k is the Boltzmann constant. Rho nt are of course the density and thermodynamic temperature. But I'm going to discuss this particular quantity, which is the mean molecular weight. What is going on here? Why we call it like this? Why there is the word molecular? It's because when atoms are bounded into molecules, the pressure immediately drops by a factor of 2. Right? I don't know if you have ever experienced this behavior of gases. Right? In a atomic gas, right, you would have some pressure. Let's say it's 10 to 5 pascals. And if you somehow force the gas to become molecular, then of course the number of particles is divided by 2, of course. And they have, even though they have, every single particle has a twice larger mass, the result, according to the ideal gas equation, is a twice smaller pressure. And that's because, you know, what the pressure is. Right? Pressure is essentially an interaction of gas with some wall. So you can simply experience a collision into the wall, and that creates the pressure. And because there is a twice lower number of collisions, you would expect twice lower ideal gas pressure. And we have to define this molecular weight somehow. So let me do it. First, let me start with this molar weight. Or molar mass. Yeah. So what is the molar mass? It's the mass divided by the number of moles, which I'm going to describe by this calligraphic N, right? Where moles are essentially multiples of the Avogadro number, so that you can compute easily the number of particles. And that's something I'm going to use immediately. It's m, the number of particles, divided by the Avogadro constant. Which is an A equal to 6.022140.76 multiplied by 10^23 per mole. And by the way, this is the exact number after the SI 2019 revision of our units. Okay, so this is the molar mass, and we can express the number of molecules. Let me put NA in the denominator, and the number of molecules or particles is simply the sum over all elements from weight of the given element times mass, it's the mass fraction, divided by A atomic number of the given element multiplied by mu. So you simply take the mass fraction, divide by mass of a single element, and you obtain the number of particles, and you sum over all elements. And this part, the denominator, is equal to the mean molecular weight. So this is the definition of mu. It's 1/, or let me somewhere. Okay, we can also cancel this m in the meter because it's the same. It's 1/ fraction divided by atomic number. So it's essentially it's a quite a trivial quantity, but let me ask you, what's the value for the gas we have in our surroundings, in our atmosphere? Do you know what's the number? And how could you estimate it?
No, I don't know.
Well, it's a question essentially what our gas is made of. It's oxygen and nitrogen. Then what is the atomic number or the proton number and then the mass number, accounting for both protons and neutrons? And well, oxygen is, I think, number 8 in the periodic table, isn't it? And I think the most common isotope is oxygen 16. And the molecule which occurs in the atmosphere is O2. So I would say that for our atmosphere, this mu is more or less 32. And then you have to mix with nitrogen, which is a little bit lighter. I think it's proton number 7 and the mass number 14. So it's 28. And 32 weighted by 70, I think 76%, isn't it? And 21%. All right, so that's the computation for neutral gases. However, you can also compute two alternative numbers, which are a mixture of ions and electrons. And this mixture is, of course, a little bit different because the sum is over WE over AE, but you have to multiply by 1 plus the Z number of the given element, because Z number of electrons is ejected during full ionization. And so this mu ions plus electrons is surely smaller than this original mu for neutrals. By the way, this mu for neutrals is actually quite close, if not almost the same, as mu for ions themselves. Because ions, pure ion gas, is composed of ionized nuclei where the bulk of mass is located. And finally, we can also formally introduce mu of the electron gas. Where we take into account only this Ze in the denominator. So it's again a definition. Is here, which is 1 over this sum over elements, weight fractions divided by AE and multiplied by ZE. Well, of course, we have to be careful because this is a pure electron gas, right? It does not into account, does not take into account the low mass of electrons. When you would like to use it, this mu I, to compute the electron pressure, then you should use here the density of the pure electron gas. So you should use rho E divided by this mu E to get the correct pressure. All right, so now some typical mixtures, but you can imagine that we can simplify these relations somehow. So just not to be surprised by these relations, for many heavier elements, 1 plus ZE is approximately equal to ZE. And surprisingly, it's approximately equal to 0.5 the atomic number AE. And as a result, you can compute mu. Let me denote it as mu to minus one as two times. I see. Let me also use the notation that W of hydrogen is equal to X, W of helium is denoted as Y, and the rest is denoted as Z, which means 1 minus X minus Y. And then mu to the power of minus 1 is equal to 2X plus 3 over 4 Y plus, sometimes we use a separate term for nitrogen, so 8 over 14 times X of nitrogen plus 0.5 of the rest, which is 1 minus X minus Y minus XM. And we call these mass fractions usually as abundances. And just to be careful, sometimes the chemical composition is determined not by mass fractions, but it's described by atomic numbers, right? Which is of course different, because heavier nuclei contribute more to the mass, although they are less frequent in the mixture. All right, so this is the first contribution, the ideal gas contribution. And we can discuss the second one. Well, the second contribution to the total pressure is the radiation pressure. We can actually denote it, this one as P gas, and this one as P of radiation, if you wish. And it's equal to the radiation constant divided by 3 multiplied by temperature to the power of 4. But again, you have to be careful, because you know, there is a very strong assumption hidden behind this term. Right? It means that radiation is in perfect equilibrium with gas. And it's confirmed by the fact that we use a single value of temperature for both radiation and gas. Right? Equilibrium means same temperature. So I'm afraid it could be dangerous to use this relation if you are in this room, because it's almost certainly not the case. Right? Just check out this radiation. Right? Most of the radiation is either from the sun, from the solar atmosphere, where you would expect a temperature like 6,000 Kelvin, or from these light bulbs, or it's not an incandescent light. It's a fluorescent lamp, right? If you check out this lamp, just let's have a look, right? This kind of light source, and again, this is a non-thermal emission, which means it has nothing, no relation to the temperature. So I'm sure that you cannot use this relation. And finally, let me mention that we also have the thermal or invisible thermal radiation in this room, which is in equilibrium with both walls and gas in this room. The temperature is of the order of 290 Kelvin in this room, but unfortunately it's not visible, right? So what I can do for the moment is to switch off all lights in this room and these non-thermal light sources. And you can imagine that now we have more light coming from this thermal source, which is unfortunately very totally visible to our eyes, or invisible to our eyes. And another point is that not only the equilibrium, but of course you should also expect some sort of a isotropic radiation. Or isotropic intensity, at least approximately. By the way, if you look around, either in this room or in your own room, is the radiation isotropic in this room or not? What do you think?
No, it's not.
It's definitely not, right? You have a window, a lot of radiation which is incoming into your room. Then it's scattered by the walls. For example, these walls scatter more or less isotropically, but you know, it's clear immediately that it's not isotropic. So what can we also introduce? I have to write what's the value of this constant. A is equal to 7.5657 times 10 to minus 16 watts per cubic meter per Kelvin minus 4. And we can introduce the following distinct pressures. First, the gas pressure can be decomposed to ion pressure plus electron pressure. and the total pressure, which is usually denoted as P, can be multiplied by this beta constant or beta parameter, which is a fraction of the gas pressure, or P minus PR, if you wish. Or you can express this beta, if you wish, as PG over P. And if you use these relations, you will immediately realize it's A times T to the power of 4 divided by 3P. And this is a very useful parameter, right? If you would like to think about a substance, a mixture of gas and radiation, you should ask, what is the value of beta? Whether it's close to 1 or is substantially lower. It's essential to account for this term, for this pressure, because for hot stars, this pressure dominates. And the gas pressure is more or less negligible, right? Right. And now we should discuss something even more involved, even more interesting. But let me first show it on this plot. Let me show. The screen, where is it? Let me share this screen where you can see a behavior of gas made of bosons and fermions. You know, these are two distinct types of particles, elementary particles, and these particular bosons are lithium 7 atoms, and fermions are lithium 6 atoms. Because, you know, fermions and bosons differ by their spins, and they differ also by their thermodynamics. For example, it's clearly seen when you cool down a substance and you held the cloud of these atoms in a cavity. I think it's something like a magnetic trap, right? So it's clear that bosons create lower pressure, and they can be confined to a smaller cloud at, well, it's 240 nanokelvin. It's a very low temperature. While these fermions are much harder to confine. Although, right, the number of particles, the concentration here, or density of these clouds is the same, they exhibit a different pressure. And we must account for this difference. So let me do it. It's the third contribution, which is called the degenerate pressure. How can we do it? So first, let me explain that it's closely related to the Heisenberg principle. Because if you confine particles close enough so that their position and momenta, or the uncertainties of their positions and momenta, are so low that they approach this Planck constant, or the reduced Planck constant over 2, they start to interact much more significantly. And we can actually estimate that, we can relate it to the density and temperature as follows. We can imagine that delta x cubed is essentially the concentration. And that the momentum, it's not the pressure, it's small p, right? The momentum is of the order of this uncertainty, delta p, because the momentum is so small that, okay? And this is of the order of h over 2 times concentration to the power of 1/3. And then in a non-relativistic gas, you have the momentum equal to mv, simply as a multiple of mass and velocity. And we can compute the pressure, I mean the capital P, as from the kinetic theory, as 1/3 mv times momentum. So just let me summarize all these contributions, because the outcome is h squared divided by 12, 1 over m, and concentration to the power of 5/3. I know it's a very simple description of a degenerate gas, right? It's an essentially, as you see, only an order of magnitude estimate of the pressure. However, you can see clearly this pressure is inversely proportional to the mass of the respective particles. That's the key. It's the reason why the electron degenerate pressure is more substantial than proton or neutron degenerate pressure, right? So it's the inversely proportional. And in this sense, it's also right, the smaller mass of a single particle, the larger the, it's quite logical. And this power to 5/3 was estimated correctly because a degenerate gas exhibits this sort of power, n to the power of 5/3. By the way, for the relativistic gas, this pressure would have a different power, simply because V approaches C in this relation. And so pressure should approach one third N C times P, and as a result, we obtain H over 6 multiplied by C and concentration to the power of 4/3, which is a different power. And you know, it's a shallower power, and it has a very important implications for stellar evolution. Right? Just imagine it. Right? You have a gas which creates a certain pressure, right? And you have a large power of n of the concentration. And then as you approach relativistic velocities, higher temperatures, so the particles move faster and faster, and they start to approach the speed of light down, then your state equation suddenly changes on its own, right? It's the very basic relativistic process. And the power is lower. And this leads to very important instabilities in stars, because if the power is lower, it means that the material is